parent, throwing out her husband for the uncontrollable drinking that would eventually kill him. Her sister Dorothy, who had been institutionalized for reasons we never knew, died at the age of 14. Probably from neglect. Probably from the way people who were confined to a school for the feeble-minded were treated. There had been a passed-down story about her possibly falling in the tub when she was 3 or 4. Maybe she had suffered some sort of serious brain injury. Then a late-night conversation only a few years ago unearthed a bit of family hearsay. She used to flap her hands. And one of her sisters, now in her 90s, confirmed Dorothy had been institutionalized before she even turned 5. I was thunderstruck. All of these fragmented bits of information, decades old, suddenly collated. She was autistic. She had to be. Autism has threaded itself throughout our family in whispers and shouts. It is seen and unseen, diagnosed and undiagnosed. It is a part of us. She was a part of us. Sometimes when we think we are not moving forward as a society, that progress is not fast enough, that our humanity is utterly lacking, and there are plenty of occasions to think all of those things, we would do well to pause and think of Dorothy. Out of the arms of her mother, away from the eyes of the world. What did they do to her? If she were a child now, how profoundly different would her life be? The powerless and the vulnerable, forever the canaries of our morality. My grandfather was one of 6 children and grew up poor in Pennsylvania coal mining country. Both of his parents died by the time he was 7. His oldest brother, Bill, only 17 at the time, took on the unfathomable task of keeping his own family together. Bill's girlfriend, Eva, who became his wife, was 15, maybe 16 at the most. A teenage girl, an adoptive mother of 5. Imagine. His brother Andy died on the train tracks as he walked home from fishing with his older brother. He was only 7. His brother just 11. The tracks had switched for an oncoming train, trapping his foot. Immediately bound to his fate, he couldn't be freed. His brother helpless, left to bear witness to the unimaginable. All of the children in the family would grow up to one day warn their own children away from train tracks with a fiery sternness born of heartbreak. From these dark circumstances, their early lives dotted with absence and need, grief and unforgivable fate, came 2 of the lightest and most joyful people you could ever hope to meet. Quick to laugh, quick with a hug, and quick to pick up the check, and uncharacteristically upset with you if you tried, as I once learned the hard way. What they had lost early on, they gained in each other. Forever. Sometimes fate has no mercy, and sometimes it will save you. 4. Big life. Eventually, they went the way of the snowbird, to Florida part-time and then full-time, enjoying the type of retirement that no longer seems to exist. They became a part of a community that cooked, swam, traveled, golfed, sunbathed, played cards, dressed up, and, quite frankly, lived it up more than I ever had. Whenever I spoke to my grandparents, one on the main phone and the other on the extension, talking over each other, they always gave me the weather report followed by, "You know you can always come to Delray." They invited me to visit every time we spoke. Every time. I always begged off. I knew I would see them when they traveled north to visit, and I didn't have the money or enough time off for an additional trip. But if I had had the money, I wouldn't have spent it on a trip to Delray Beach to stay with my grandparents in their retirement community. I have a sharp memory of saying those actual words out loud. Not to them. Never to them. All I knew is that I needed to start my big life and go to big destinations that had bigger and better things for me to do. Looking back now, I never felt guilty about not going, because they never made me feel guilty about not going. Their lives were bursting there, full. They didn't need me to visit to fill up what was missing. They wanted me to visit because they loved me. Simple. But was guilt really the reason to go anyway? Who has the big life now? 5. Hello, goodbye. I've been to Florida maybe 5 times in my life, all at very different stages of my life, and theirs. I was a 12-year-old road tripping with my family from Massachusetts to visit them and hit Disney World in Epcot. I was a 29-year-old newlywed on a cross-country road trip honeymoon, where it felt like their entire retirement community had cooked for days just to host a feast for us. And I'm talking some old-school Italian ladies from Rhode Island and New Jersey, so when I say feast, I mean a for damn real feast. I remember very clearly having to lie down on the floor with my pants unzipped for a good hour to have any hope of making it through dessert. That same night, several of her friends came over to hug me, give me a card or small gift, and wish us a happy married life. One of them looked up at me and then over to her friend and yelled, "Remember when we used to be that tall?" On my last visit, I was a 38-year-old mother of two with my 8-month-old daughter in tow. I brought her to meet my grandfather for the first and last time. He loved babies. And he was dying. His eyebrows lifted ever so slightly at the sight of her. His animated, head-tilted-back laugh was already gone. But there she was. And so was he. And never would that meeting, those old eyes meeting new, ever happen again. When I returned to Vermont, I spoke to him one last time. I don't remember most of what was said. The call was brief. He would die just a few days later. But toward the end of the call, I quietly said, "I should let you go," as if this was a routine call, as if I could really ever let him go, how bound we are to our conversational shortcuts. "I don't want to tire you out." He replied slowly, and with a catch in his voice, "You will never tire me out." 10 years later, that thought, the intention behind it, the love I felt so crisply and clearly from his weakening voice, still floods me with sadness. I have never let him go. "You will never tire me out." Isn't that what we all want to hear? To believe? My grandmother was never the same after he died. Maybe the kind of marriage they had is a thing of the past. I don't know. Born during conventional wartime, if anything about war can be considered conventional, and success that's modest yet inspires generosity, what they had feels almost foreign to this world now. Their marriage wasn't fractured by the simultaneous invented closeness and real distance of technology, but bound up in handwritten letters and photographs printed on beefy squares of paper edged in metallic ink. Built to last. She has survived so much. A brain aneurysm and surgery, breast cancer, strokes. But losing him was the beginning of what continues to be a long, slow, sad end. I've sat in front of her, not being able to grasp the person I once knew. The always ironing, lipstick mark from kissing you, independent trailblazer of a grandmother I knew my whole life. The one who made her evening gowns and bikinis by hand, and the one who taught the neighborhood kids how to bake. And the one who, the last time I visited them in Florida, was rummaging through a basket of photographs, held up a school picture of a child none of us recognized, and said, "Who is this kid?" and threw it in the trash. She is lost to most of us now. Locked in a place that she sometimes reaches out from. Remembering her birthday or tracing invisible dance steps with her fingertips. My aunt, who lives down the road from my grandmother, visited her last week and noticed she's losing weight. Her wedding band is close to slipping off, probably for the first time since it was wiggled onto her finger 69 years ago. We are all just slipping through. We will all be released. If you have grandparents, visit them. Go because no one will ever love you in the bold and gentle, big and uncomplicated way they do. Go because you can. Even if you think you can't, find a way. Take them up on their offer. Let them wait for you at arrivals. Go because we all assume that what we have in our lives now, we will have in our lives forever. But the reality is we're only certain of our good fortune once we glimpse it in the rearview mirror. Go because you are loved. Go because you love. Go. Let's have the wedding later. I know, it's a big party. It is a pretty dress and a pretty cake and everyone is so very pretty because usually everyone is so very young. But what is the wedding all about, really? What have these two people even achieved? We met while we were hopeful, and we were idiots, the best kind of idiots who have no idea of what's to come. We think we will handle everything thrown at us with aplomb and finesse. We are different, you see. Unlike everyone who is giving us sage advice, we are actually more in love. Marriage will never be hard for us. We will always see our lover's side, because lovers is what we are right now most of all, and we will respond to complaints with a level head and an open heart. We will never hold a grudge or raise a voice, and we will certainly never get divorced. Gross. Look at us, crossing the finish line before the race has even started. We stand on the podium and beam as the gold medals are slung around our necks. We accept our bouquets and raise them above our heads long before the opening ceremony has taken place. No one trusts more in the crystal-clear certainty of how things will go more than us. We are winners. We have done it. Except we have done nothing. All we have done is agree we are in love, and a party would be nice. We have achieved little except making our way through some checklists without murdering our parents or our florist. We have tasted the vegetarian options, and we have chosen the wines. We have gathered wildflowers in mason jars and made elaborate chalk signs. We have posed this way and that. We have arrived. But oh, we have so much to prove. I know. Because we were once them. Weren't we all? But we are older now, and know too much. Now we sit through wedding ceremonies. We are the older family, or the distant family, or the workplace acquaintances, and at a particularly inane and unrealistic vow, one of us will lean over and mutter to the other, "Good luck with that." And then we will try not to laugh, as if we are the children in that church. So maybe the wedding should come later, when we can point around the room and at ourselves and to each other. "We made those two small people," we could say, "and you gave me these gray hairs, or you nursed me back to health, and you talked me down off the ledge more times than I can even count. Thank you. I'm sorry. Let's party." We could write real vows based on real experience. They would sound like a cross between a eulogy, a performance review, and a thank you card. We wouldn't worry about the future. We would talk about where we had been instead. We would propose carrying certain successful marriage initiatives forward. We would smile on both our past and present good fortune rather than moon over airy promises of future perfection. "I take you to continue being the person I am married to, more or less. We have changed and will continue to change, but likely not in the same ways or at the same time, and we've learned that's just how things go. We will cross those bridges as we get to them. We do not have each other, since we are not objects to be possessed. And we don't always hold each other, because sometimes I just don't want to be touched, you know? But I get the general idea. And I assume you do, too. Let's vow to continue on with that. We can't know what will happen from this day forward, but I can say for sure we have experienced years of better and worse. So check and check on that front. And then we've experienced better again, because otherwise, how could we be standing here right now? We have been richer, we have been poorer. We have taken some stellar vacations and also borrowed money from our own children's savings accounts to bridge temporary ruin. We are aware how much fortune can smile and frown upon two people in one life together. We have experienced it all in its pants-shitting downturns and, around for everyone in this bar, glory. We have personally been lucky, so far, to have experienced the survivable side of in sickness and in health. I'd like the record to show I prefer in health. We have fielded calls from people we love as they share a grim diagnosis over the phone, like a telegram from hell. We have awaited test results, celebrated recovery, been to urgent care, been an outpatient, been scared, attended funerals. We have helped people we love as they lie dying, and nothing really prepares you for that. It's not what you think you're signing up for with this whole getting married business. You think you're trying to select a shoe that gives you just the right height while also being something comfortable enough to dance in. I promise to love and cherish you, although it can be hard to be pure about this, to be honest. because I am always busy thinking about who needs new sneakers or snow pants and what are we going to do about camps next summer. I am thinking about whether our meals are well balanced and if our kids will ever grow up to cross busy streets on their own, because honestly, I'm starting to have my doubts. I am thinking about the weight of having to steer this ship every day, mail the packages, greet the children in the morning versus yell at them, never miss a day of laundry, or oh Lord, will I regret it. Some days, most days, cherishing is pretty far down the motherfucking list, if you know what I'm saying. But I vow to bump it up a bit, at least above running a load of delicates. I promise to be better at just letting you help in the ways you help. Because ladies love to have help, but then we want help in exactly the ways we would do things. So make the food this way and fold the towels that way, talk to the children like this and sunscreen them like that. And it all just begs the question, do we want help or not? But hey, speaking of vows, how about we vow to stop calling it helping? When I, a woman, the wife, the mother, am doing things it is never referred to as helping. I am not helping out around the house. I am not helping to make ends meet. I am not helping raise our children. I am cleaning, mothering, working, doing. Such a variety of action verbs there. So no longer will I ask for help. I will expect you to just do. Cut the grass, clean the kitchen, raise our children without babysitting them or watching them for me. Let's just do things in our own particular ways, just so they get done already. I don't know if death will ultimately be what parts us, but I hope for both our sakes that day is far away. Parting and death, both. I say we do the best in the time we have, knowing what we know. I would like to thank you for loving me for so many years, which is insane when you think about it. You have loved me even when I have made extremely poor choices or given you highly sarcastic answers or no answers at all. You have loved me when I stormed out of our house, apartment, vacation rental. You have forgiven me for crying over manipulative commercials, and you have even forgiven me for criticizing you openly at parties. You are still married to me, even though more than once I have given you double middle fingers in the middle of a fight and told you to go fuck yourself, something I am certain I vowed I would never do when we were engaged. Thank you for having sex with me so we could produce what are clearly a couple of the most stellar children we could have ever hoped for. These are our vows, after all, and we should at least be allowed to brag a little. Even given those excellent children and the highs and the lows, the tasks and the really good times, I would like to apologize for my heart calcifying over time. Maybe that's just the way things go. It is so hard to remain open and hopeful when you are a lady and getting older by the minute and also not a millionaire. What's there to be so damn cheerful about? But I vowed to try. That's the only vow I can really make at this point. Because having and holding and loving and cherishing feel like words from a fairy tale. And parting at death feels both dramatic and honestly pretty depressing. So I will vow to try. I will try not to blow my stack or throw my car keys across the room like I did that one time. Okay, fine, those few times. I will try to look around more and appreciate what we have built together, this relationship, this life, and those children, because I'm going to mention them one more time. I can't help myself. I promise I will be me from this day forward, and you will be you all the days of your life. I promise we will definitely get mad at each other and go to bed angry. We will also leave notes and text things like, everything will be okay, or hooray, and you're gonna do great, I know you will. I promise to keep trying, for as long as we both shall live. I love you. Thank you. I'm sorry. Let's party. It's complicated.
But you don't ever like anything I post on Facebook. You don't even look at my page.
Those are not the words of a teenager, spitting ridiculous complaints across the room at her best friend or boyfriend. Those are the words of a 45-year-old woman, a mother of two, in the middle of a fight with her husband. A fight where the topic was divorce. Those were my words. As they shot out, I felt drenched in embarrassment, pathetic. To make sure the humiliation was complete, I started crying. I couldn't have known 20 years ago on our wedding day, or when we got married again 6 months later at our official wedding with the white dress, dancing, and cans tied to the bumper of our getaway car, or during the many years afterward. But I was waiting for someone to invent social media. Maybe when you grow up feeling unseen, by boys, by your parents, by the world, you will come away assuming any attention is good attention. And to get attention, you need to put something out there. A variety of somethings. You must always be baiting the hook. The introduction of email had already allowed me to share and overshare. When my husband and I went on our month-long road trip honeymoon, I sent long group emails with recaps from the road to a couple dozen people, whether they wanted these emails or not. If that had been now, we'd have a sickeningly clever hashtag. And I'd blog and Instagram the absolute bejesus out of it all. The giant roadside tiger muskie in Minnesota, the peak foliage in Vermont, and the hurricanes we drank in New Orleans. Blessed. I emailed reviews of disposable cameras I had tried out on another trip. I shared thoughts and stories and jokes. I made copies of photos for just about every single person who appeared in them and mailed them off with a card. It took real effort to keep people as one-way informed as I did. When the moment I had been unknowingly waiting for finally arrived, it was my sister-in-law, of all people, who sent me the invite to join Facebook. Duck, meet water. For all my eventual mastery of the rat-a-tat-tat of social media, the mulling over of captions, and the needy exhibitionism, I had become consumed by what it told me I was missing. Better houses, better vacations, better bodies, better light, better weekends. But mostly, better marriages. My daily racetrack laps through the ether left me spinning. Had I had the best, most fun, most visually appealing day? Was I the funniest, the sharpest, the most liked? But more than anything, was I loved? I mean, loved enough for a bunch of random acquaintances to see? That night I splashed cold water on my hot face, pressing its coolness into my eyes, willing it to erase my insanity. I thought, in a few years I'll be teaching my kids how to navigate social media. Me. Although I was the one who had brought up divorce, I wasn't suggesting we get divorced because of Facebook. I wasn't quite that unhinged. But I was holding Facebook up as evidence of how other husbands loved their wives in a way he didn't love me. I was suggesting we no longer loved each other, that this went both ways. I was suggesting I had become a different person. I had moved on, and it was clear he wasn't coming with me. I suggested every single part of this was obvious to everyone but him. John is a carpenter, a builder, and a fixer of things, a listener of vinyl records, and someone who does not like you opening a carton of milk if one is already open. I have the post-it notes to prove it. He likes order but doesn't necessarily want to be in charge. He doesn't need to set the world on fire to get attention. And he married someone who was born with a can of gasoline in one hand and a book of matches in the other. We were married in his parents' house, the house he grew up in, 6 months before his mother would succumb to the ovarian cancer that was slowly and painfully overtaking her body. At one point she turned to my father and said, "He will never hurt your daughter." But it turns out not hurting each other in a marriage is impossible. Hurt comes from many places. The pervasive and low-hum hurt of unintentional neglect. The surprisingly damaging hurt of sarcasm taken too far. The near-catastrophic hurt of outside temptation. And the small, nibbling hurt of not really seeing each other anymore. The days come and go. We are ghosts shuffling children through their checkpoints. But when my father relayed her comment to me, I knew what she had meant. There is no one who doesn't love John. He is easygoing, quick to smile and slap you on the back in conversation if you're a man, or gently squeeze your arm or hug you hard if you're a woman. He loves his friends openly and deeply, never hesitating to jump in and help. He commands control over keeping our Ziploc containers and lids matched. He plants and tends our vegetable garden with our kids, and he takes them on long bike rides on hot summer Sundays. He looks like a younger Russell Crowe with a nicer smile and a happier childhood. He's a perfectionist at his job, capable and strong, a serious cook and a believer in equally carrying the weight of raising our kids and taking care of our home. When I hinted to my friends that we were in trouble, serious trouble, the struggling for empathy reactions all but said, "So you're an idiot then?" But that's the thing about love and marriage over time. There isn't much that's rational about it. The heart wants what it wants or doesn't want, and sometimes it wants the kind of attention that, in the big scheme of things, matters not at all. Sometimes it wants sparkly cartoon band-aids instead of the grim open-heart surgery it so desperately requires. Up to that point, Facebook had served an actual purpose in my life. Living in Vermont and far from my coworkers and friends from previous jobs and cities, I used it to stay connected. As I scrambled to get freelance work going in the wake of being laid off, all of those old contacts and friends of friends flooded me with messages, supportive comments, project offers. The format and feedback loop of it fed my personal writing in a way nothing else had. And as I began working steadily from home, alone, I found social media was my way of having all the water cooler conversations without needing the water cooler. It was the perfect solution to everything I needed: conversation, networking, writing practice, connection, and inside jokes. And I didn't even need to shower. I rationalized it was no different than spending half a day in meetings or on conference calls as I used to. It was just a different way of wasting time. But as the years went on, I shared more. All the time. Look at me. This is where I am. This is where I'm going. Hey, this is my opinion about this thing. And here's what I'm doing right now. Pay attention to me. Pay attention to me. But enough about me. Why aren't you paying attention to me? At the same time, I willingly slid down a rabbit hole of competitive posting and hate reading, knowing better than most that social media doesn't equal real life, but choosing to accept it all at face value anyway. The world I was connected to became simultaneously bigger, my network grew, and smaller. I barely interacted with most of my neighbors or parents at my kids' school. In the process, my sense of what a normal marriage was, if there even is such a thing, became pretty distorted. On Facebook, everyone had their own television show, dramedies shot through with spot-on humor and the tidiest locations, all set during the warm, forgiving light of magic hour. Don't even try being as in love as someone who posts about it constantly on Facebook, because no one has ever been or will ever be that in love. Not you, and certainly not me. And in my own way, I was just as guilty. I was my own showrunner, but for a show my husband had no interest being cast in. It was a show I starred in with guest appearances by my kids and our hapless cat, Oreo. It wasn't ideal, but as with all mid-season replacements, we tried to make it work. The night we talked more about the possibilities of divorce, John responded to my loop-the-loop of questioning in the only way he knew how, like a non-crazy, rational person. He never posted anything on Facebook. He didn't really look at anyone's page. He doesn't comment or like anything. He barely even checks it. But that wasn't the point. That wasn't what this was all about. What I was too ashamed to say in those moments was, "Why don't you understand me?" And, "Why can't you love me more?" And most selfishly, "And why can't you let everyone know it while you're at it?" Why can't you crave attention too? But that wasn't the person I had married. He had never been that person. He hadn't changed since I met him. I had changed, and the world had changed around him. He doesn't gush or send me gifts. The first time I texted him a thumbs-up emoji, he replied, "That's not very nice," because he thought I was saying, "Up yours." What I had forgotten were all the times he had come home from work with flowers to celebrate good news, or ice cream to help soothe the bad. Or the many times I told him I was going to be away for 2 weeks for work, or head to Maine for a weekend to write, or even quit my job, and he said, "Go for it." Sure, those are sporadic examples, spread out over years. But from the minute we started dating, I have earned more than him. My job has taken priority over his. And anything I've set out to do, he has supported without question. It's astounding, really. He has never guilted me into being anyone other than who I am. And if you knew me, you might question him on that particular point. He has never asked me to tone down this whole breadwinner business. He has never needed me to bolster his masculine image, because he has had the inner confidence and stability he was raised with all along. He has never needed a virtual pat on the back for any reason. Frankly, it was a wonder we had made it this far. He is an excellent father, a great friend, a good man. He doesn't care if he looks cool, as a photo taken on the beach this past summer proves, with his sunglasses placed over his supermarket readers and one of our kids' bucket hats perched too small upon his head. And it'll be a cold day in hell before he takes a selfie or arranges things on the floor for a photo. He's not an Instagram husband. But he is my husband. And marriages aren't made to be contained in 140 characters or look better with just the right filter. Because it was already pretty good, I just wasn't looking up enough to see what was right in front of me. We didn't magically solve anything that night 3 years ago when we talked about divorce. We didn't instantly fall back in love. I didn't quit Facebook. But by allowing myself to feel imperfect and stupid in a way I had outlawed on social media, I had shocked myself into seeing how unrealistic and dangerous my expectations had become. A few of the couples whose theoretical happiness I had wallowed in split up. We all see what we want to see, even when there's nothing there. Or maybe especially when there's a lot there that can't be neatly contained in a single photo, even with the longest of captions. Our marriage has absolutely changed over time, because people change over time. None of us expect to be cradled in the nook of someone's arm like an infant until we die. We don't crawl or stumble around like stiff-legged drunks to go to our jobs. We walk, we run, we take the hits as we keep going, paying the toll for every year we pass. We are encouraged to climb, climb higher, be better, do great things. What are the odds that two people do that in the exact same way, on the same trajectory, with the same level of ambition or desire or capacity for change? What are the odds it all works out just fine? When we stood in that tiny church in front of our family and friends, I can guarantee I wasn't thinking about how I would handle motherhood or what turning 40 might do to me. I wasn't thinking about how maybe that thing about our sex lives taking a nosedive might not be a cliche, or that fights over the most absurdly minor things could go nuclear and sweep up our very existence in their paths. I was mostly thinking about cutting that cake and how I looked in my dress and how we had done it. We had really done it. I had done it. I was married. And if anyone had given us any sage advice, which they did, they wrote it down at our reception, I still have all of it, I wouldn't have listened. It's complicated. That's what Facebook gave us, to some more than others. We took a break from talking about divorce. That's not to say we have Saturday morning pre-breakfast sex or hazy late nights in strip club parking lots in my 65 Chevy like we did when we were first married. But we're planning a 20th anniversary party I wasn't convinced we'd ever see. I no longer look to Facebook as an authority on much, especially love. And I have stopped looking at other marriages entirely, because the combination of two people who aren't us is irrelevant. It's like listening to birth stories at your baby shower. It has nothing to do with you. It never did. So much is gone now. That Chevy, his parents, too many friends to count. Our 20s and our 30s. But we're still here. We are still here. And as I stand in this spot, much as I did on that day in that tiny church, I can't at all predict what turning 50 will do to me, or what will happen when our children leave home. I don't know whether we will survive it as a team vowing to take on the storm together, or if we will inevitably drift and break apart. I don't know. Because my incessant requests for a crystal ball keep going unanswered. But I do know it took 2 decades of marriage and 8 years of social media to realize I'm someone who has always needed a stage to stand on. And it took almost blowing everything up to remember I married someone who has always been happy to build that stage for me, carefully and quietly, just the way he wants to, in the background. So what we do now is hold on. Hold on to what has gotten us this far. Hold on to whatever has made us a successful combination of sameness and difference. And hold on to those things that pass between us with just a knowing look. We can try to do what our parents hoped we would. Not hurt each other. What I can do is not look to other people we barely know for answers. And instead, finally, read all that advice that was written down in a wave of wine-soaked happiness so long ago. The advice that didn't have character limits or filters. the advice that was private, and from people who loved us. I could log in to real life. Time out. Your cute wedding hashtags 20 years later. Hashtag, do you have any cash on you? Hashtag, did you write a check out of the joint account? Hashtag, can you pick up milk and wine on the way home? Hashtag, and ice cream? Hashtag, shit, are you still at the market? Hashtag, and that rice mix, you know the one I like, it's in a black bag. Hashtag, oh, and laundry detergent. Hashtag, ugh, and toilet paper, never mind, I'll just go later. Hashtag, are you going to shave? Hashtag, are you going to wear that shirt? Hashtag, no reason. Hashtag, what about those pants? Hashtag, what's the story with those shoes? Hashtag, that dress looks fine, let's go. Hashtag, what's with the toothpaste everywhere? Hashtag, and the toilet seat situation? Hashtag, what is happening? Hashtag, would it kill you to make the bed? Hashtag, what? Hashtag, nothing. Hashtag, I didn't say anything. Hashtag, there wasn't a tone in my voice. Hashtag, no there wasn't. Hashtag, the dishwasher is broken. Hashtag, the furnace isn't working. Hashtag, the toilet is clogged. Hashtag, the basement is flooding. Hashtag, have you left work yet? Hashtag, remember it's girls' night out. Hashtag, yes I did tell you. Hashtag, I told you 2 weeks ago. Hashtag, you don't listen. Hashtag, whatever. Hashtag, whatever, whatever. Hashtag, did you call the doctor? Hashtag, did you bring the car in? Hashtag, did you call the place about the thing? Hashtag, ugh, can I have some blankets? Hashtag, yes, it is cold in here. Hashtag, stop telling me how I feel. Hashtag, yes, you do. Hashtag, you do. Hashtag, oh my God. Hashtag, brink of divorce. Hashtag, we see a therapist now. Hashtag, we validate each other's feelings. Hashtag, all the time. Hashtag, it's exhausting. Hashtag, could it be until crabbiness do we part instead? Hashtag, what have we done? Hashtag, happy anniversary to us. Hashtag, suckers. Hashtag, seriously, don't forget the wine at the market. Kids, it's time you knew the truth. Your mother is a real piece of work. Look, I know you guys have sensed something's wrong, even though we've tried hard to hide all of this from you. We just didn't want you to worry. But we can't really get anything past you two, can we? You guys are just too smart. Your mother has been to a lot of specialists, and trust me when I say we've been working really hard trying to find answers. And yes, I know we've shooed you away from our private conversations. But that ends today. You deserve to know the truth. There's no easy way to say this other than to just, you know, come right out and say it. So here it is. Your mother is a real piece of work. Sorry, just needed to take a deep breath there. A really deep breath. Wow, it's finally out there. I can't believe it. I'm sure you have a lot of questions. I know I did. First, let me say there's still a lot we don't know right now. We're not sure how her condition might progress over time, or if there was something we could have done to prevent it. Honestly, we may never know. For example, when we were planning our wedding, I let her not only choose what the groomsmen would wear, but also what my new last name would be and where we would live. Looking back, I can't help but wonder if maybe I shouldn't have let her do any of that. As if I had that kind of control back then, or even now. Don't make me laugh. Or when you were born, Julie. She said, I love the name Julie, and I said, well, I'm not really a fan of that name. How about Charlotte or Amanda? And she responded, so it's settled. Julie it is. What? No, no! I'm not saying I don't like your name. I mean, that's what I was saying back then. Of course I love your name. I love you. That's what really matters, doesn't it? I do like your name. Yes, I do. Forget what I just said. Honey, don't look at me like that. No, I'm not calling you honey because I hate the name Julie. Sorry. Lost my cool there for a minute. It's just this situation has really taken a toll on me. For years I was beating myself up, thinking her condition was due to something I had done or not done, that maybe I didn't love her enough or in the way she needed to be loved, that this was somehow all my fault. It's such a relief to finally have some answers. Don't roll your eyes at me.
That reminds me, we don't know if your mother's condition is hereditary.
I'm no medical doctor, or, as it turns out, even a halfway decent insurance adjuster, but if I had to guess, I'd say it skips a generation. Your grandmother? Lovely woman, lovely. Your great-grandmother? Ooh, boy, you needed to put a sweater on when she came into a room because it got cold in there, if you catch my drift. No? Not catching it? I'm saying she was a total bitch, you guys. That's what I'm saying. I'm sorry, that was obviously inappropriate. I mean, I stand by my assessment of her condition, if not my particular phrasing of it. Obviously, things back then weren't nearly as sophisticated as they are today, from a diagnostic perspective. But my layperson's hunch is that your great-grandmother was also a real piece of work. That aside, I'm sure you're wondering what our next steps are and what can be done. As far as I've been able to figure out, there's no actual cure for your mother's condition. She will continue to be a real piece of work for the rest of her life. She was a real piece of work when we met, and if anything, this is one area of her life where she's been remarkably consistent and completely oppressive. I've had a lot of time to reflect on this, and I do think there could be a silver lining to this whole situation. We'll finally have a name to put with her condition. Instead of just thinking, and I'll speak for myself here, that we'll never be good enough for her or that we're horrible people, we can all just know, deep down, it's simply because she's a real piece of work. It reminds me of my boss, who has a condition called born rich and doesn't really need this job. Every time I think, man, why am I always the one who's working late, grabbing him a coffee, making excuses for why he can't be at a meeting? That's when I remind myself he can't help it. It's just that he was born rich and doesn't really need this job. It helps. It honestly does. I guess what I'd like to emphasize as we sort this all out is that we need to take care of ourselves. Just do whatever you need to do to feel happy and sane. You might not believe this, but I've gotten back into painting, and I've been doing a lot of reading as well. Recently, I came across this poem, and I'd like to read it to you girls. I think it might help us reframe our predicament. But I guess, to be accurate, I didn't just come across it. I actually rewrote it. Okay, fine, I stole it. The original is called Welcome to Holland. Maybe you've heard of it? My version is called Welcome to Hell. I hope you like it. Welcome to Hell. I am often asked to describe the experience of living with someone who's a real piece of work, to try to help people who have not shared this unique experience to understand it, to imagine how it would feel. It's like this. When you're getting married, it's like planning a fabulous party, in a bar, on a floating barge, to sex land. You buy a bunch of guidebooks and make your wonderful plans. The reverse cowgirl, the naughty financial advisor, the rent is 2 months late, and someone needs a spanking. It's all very exciting. After months of eager anticipation, the day finally arrives. You pack your bags and off you go. Several hours later, the plane lands. The stewardess comes in, tongue flickering, hands raised in devil horns, and she whisper shouts, "Welcome to hell!" "Hell," you say. "What do you mean, hell? I signed up for sex land. I'm supposed to be in sex land. All my life I've dreamed of going to sex land." But there's been a change in the flight plan. They've landed in hell, and there you must stay. The important thing is they haven't taken you to some horrible, disgusting, filthy place full of pestilence, famine, and disease. Or have they? It's called hell, after all. So shit. Now you have to go out and buy a new guidebook. And you have to learn a whole bunch of new facial expressions. And you will meet a whole new group of people you would never have met. Or you would have if your wife hadn't alienated every last one of them. It's just a different place. It's much more hell-y than sexland, way less fun than sexland. But after you've been there for a while and you catch your breath, you look around and you begin to notice hell has a lot of sighing. Hell has inexplicable rage. Hell even has the most biting judgments. It just honestly takes your breath away sometimes. This place sucks. Meanwhile, everyone you know is busy coming and going from sexland, and they're all bragging about what a wonderful time they had there. God, you think, my friends are total dicks.
And for the rest of your life, you will say, "Ugh, that's where I was supposed to go. That's what I had planned." The pain of that will never, ever go away, because the loss of that dream will make you want to stab your so-called friends right in their parts. But if you spend your life mourning the fact that you didn't get to Sexland, you may never be free to enjoy the very special hell that is hell. You know what? Now that I read this out loud, this poem is stupid. It's not helping at all. Fuck Holland. Fuck hell. Fuck your mother. Someone should. Showdowns. Overshare. My phone currently contains more than 38,000 photos and 700 videos. This digital shitstorm doesn't take into account the pre-iPhone film photos or even the digital camera ones, nor does it include the videos on my desktop, laptop, and floating across multiple clouds. What are clouds? Does anyone even know? It doesn't include what's on Instagram or across all the photo editing apps I've since abandoned. And of course, it can't include the hundreds of shots I wished I had taken and did not. It's like Wayne Gretzky said, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take." When my kids were little, I worried I was documenting them too much, which didn't stop me from actually doing it. Not even a little bit. I was training them to the camera, like circus lions to the whip. I needed every smile, every outfit, every crazy hair morning, every beach, every popsicle, every ice cream cone, every new book, every hat, every snowman, every Christmas Eve, every birthday, every sparkly dress, every Lego, every first day of school, every last day of school, every morning, every afternoon, every moment of every day of their lives. Line up against this wall, this mural, this place where the light is better. I worried about the end game here. What was the end game here? I kept telling myself everyone else was doing it too, so it must be okay. I was using an adolescent argument for a very grown-up problem. Now that my kids are older, and as I continue to try to tease this apart, I can see I was conflating documenting with sharing. Because I wasn't just documenting moments so I could savor them down the road or press them in a book. I was documenting moments in order to share them, and share them immediately. It wasn't enough for us to know we went blueberry picking. Everyone else must also know we went blueberry picking. And not just blueberry picking, but blueberry picking on a beautiful day in Vermont. Rolling hills and puffy white clouds, very much in evidence. Behold my children wearing good outfits and showing their adorable faces and those curls or eyes or chubby fingers. Look at us. We are killing it over here, aren't we? Please like this photo. I have occasionally followed basic ethical guidelines for photography, like asking my kids for their permission to take a photo. The problem with that is they will sometimes say no. And isn't that a pickle? So I have also taken many, many more photos of them without asking. I have begged them. I have paid them $1 and once paid them each $3. I have asked them nicely, and I have guilted them into it. The documenting that would often cause the most friction were the shots I wanted to take as we raced out the door to something. When they looked their cutest, their most dressed up, or were fully engulfed in costumes. When we were on our way to an event. We would always end up running late, as my kids posed and jumped and finally ran out of the frame and away from me. The best moments were when we worked together, picking outfits or settings for a photo, or creating different roles and scenarios for videos. There was one period in particular when I struggled to hold myself together as a dear friendship imploded. I never wanted to return home after school because that's when the loneliness would hit me, as we all went our separate ways. I needed them with me. I needed them close, to try to dull how alone I felt. For weeks on end, I'd pick them up from school and we'd take off on afternoon adventures. We'd pick raspberries or walk through the woods. We'd wander in sunflower fields and drive to small town libraries 45 minutes away. I wanted to be away from everyone I knew, everyone except them. I was attempting to escape the ache in my life, and although they didn't know it, my kids were consoling me with their presence, simply by being in this with me.
One memorable afternoon, I brought along the giant costume tree heads John and I had bought at a library tag sale when we first moved to Vermont. The kids and I traipsed through the woods and stood in front of barns, pretending to be autumn trees. It was completely silly and really wonderful. Sharing took on this veneer of, "Here I am, and I am fine. I am doing fine. See me, I'm doing great." It was a way of signaling to people who didn't even care anymore that I would survive this. A breakup is a breakup is a breakup. Although it's difficult all these years later to look at those photos without feeling incredibly sad, I also cherish them because they represent my kids and I creating something together. It felt healing. There was no work, no homework, no chores, no unfriending, no sadness, and no life outside the three of us, at least for a couple of hours each day. But the worst moments were profoundly, almost unspeakably awful. Those were the times when I crossed the line, when I got so frustrated that I utterly blew my stack. Over a photo. For Facebook. There is one photo in particular that always springs to mind. It's of my daughter when she was about 5 years old. We had picked up a mini watermelon from the farmer's market after school, and I wanted to get a photo of her holding it when we got home. She complained it was too heavy. She didn't want to hold it. She wanted to go inside. And when she shifted it ever so slightly, it almost slipped from her hands. I screeched, "Don't you dare drop that watermelon!" Oh my God. She burst into tears. I still have the photo from right before that moment. The worst I ever feel as a parent is when I come across it during an archival dig. It tells me everything I've ever done wrong with her in exactly one frame. A little kid. A powerful adult. Me bending her to my will. Her not strong enough to even hold this tiny, smooth watermelon. Me yelling at her for almost dropping it. All for a photo. I know I shared that photo. I know it got some likes. How many? Who knows now? I know my daughter still remembers that moment, even all these years later. How could she not? Even still, I'm afraid to ask her, to conjure that ghost. And I know it was never even remotely worth it. What was happening to me there? What was I hoping for? There is a hunger to share our children with the world, or even just our supposedly private circle. Nothing is private. Nothing. They are special to us. And we want everyone else to think they're special too. Can't you see it? Just look at them. Swimming and jumping across hay bales, graduating from preschool and eating birthday cake. Can't you see it too? Would you please like this photo to prove to me you also see how wonderful they are? Would you please encourage me to do more of this sort of thing? Let's admire my children together. Another time, another utter failure of my position. My kids, just 2 and 4, had tagged along with me when I voted for Barack Obama in 2008. Now that was a day. When we arrived at our polling place, I took a photo of them standing next to the "Vote, Enter Here" sign as they shouted, "Vote, vote, vote," to passersby. My son wore a cowboy hat and his red, puffy vest, and she wore a handmade paper crown, pink pants, and held her orange and white stuffed kitty named Milky. She was rocking on the sides of her feet, her little white Converse on rubber edge in the photo. 4 years later, as we prepared to repeat that voting field trip, I mentioned how we should try to recreate the original photo as accurately as we could, that it would be fun to see how much they'd grown, that it was important to mark this incredible occasion for them, for us as a family. But let's face it, mostly for me. I printed out the old photo. We found my son's old cowboy hat. My daughter plucked Milky from her bed, the one thing that hadn't yet been outgrown. They were more self-conscious this time, especially as my 8-year-old son popped a cowboy hat on his head that he had last worn when he was 4, half a lifetime ago. And my daughter held her stuffed kitty Milky, although her ivory cable sweater dress and knee-high leather boots gave her the look of a teenager instead of the child she still was. I tried to take the photo fast, to not get in the way of other people attempting to dash in and out to cast their vote. I tried to get my kids to look in the same direction as they did in that old photo, or to hold hands the same way, not too tight, just a little bit loose. Neither of them really wanted to do it. They were distracted by all the activity, embarrassed by the attention,
just wanting to be done with it already.
Still, they soldiered on, albeit a bit more vocally.
My daughter especially put up a stink about it. She is always the one unafraid to put up a stink about things. I had promised we would get cupcakes after this whole thing, if they would just cooperate.
I knew we were in bribery territory, and I was more than okay with it.
It wasn't the first time, and it certainly wouldn't be the last.
But my daughter kept messing around.
She was tired and whiny. She didn't want to cooperate.
Or at least that's what I thought was happening, as she seemed to be squirming around with her legs and her feet and not standing up tall. Christ, I finally snapped. Stop doing that. You're not getting a cupcake after this.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Of course she cried.
Of course she did. What a goddamn monster.
And through her tears she said, I was trying to have my foot the way it was in the old picture.
Are you trying to figure out which part is worse? Because it's 5 years later and I'm still not sure.
Was it me yelling? Or me threatening to take away her cupcake?
Maybe it was the fact that even though she didn't want to, she was posing for that photo anyway? And not only posing, but trying to make her 6-year-old foot rock to the side in the same exact position as her 2-year-old foot?
Or was it that she had studied the photo and was doing her hardest to replicate it?
And I yelled at her. And she was 6. And I'm a grown-up. And I yelled at her. I am such a fucking asshole.
I'm looking at that photo now, and my heart feels utterly broken. It feels broken for how far down a rabbit hole I had to be to think that was normal person behavior. It feels broken for how far down a rabbit hole I still am.
It feels broken for how much I trained my children to stop what they were doing, to hold up the flower, the mud pie, the shell, the feather. To stand in the sunset. No, this way. No, that way. Jump. Run. Now do it again.
Would I have taken so many photos if I hadn't planned on sharing them?
I can guarantee I wouldn't have.
That's not to say I wouldn't have taken any. I originally became interested in photography when my dad gave me my first camera in junior high.
I graduated from college with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in photography.
This isn't a new interest or hobby. It didn't float up from the internet and snatch me in its evil grasp. I have always been looking for patterns and possibilities. But there are no longer any consequences for taking a million photos. We have completely lost the time and cost barriers of dropping off film, paying for prints, and tracking our negatives. You never knew what shots you had. And unless you were a professional photographer with an unlimited film budget, you wouldn't keep firing away on a motor drive until you got what you came for. But when you combine the ease of taking endlessly free digital photos with something that is always on you, the ability to share those images instantly from that same thing in your pocket, and then let's go ahead and frost that whole shit cake with a feedback loop that only encourages you to do it more, well. When we document simply for the pleasure of doing so, for our own use and satisfaction, I believe we are more likely to let moments unfold. To capture what is happening in front of us versus engineering what we want to happen. It's the difference between a documentary and a reality show. Not always. Not every time. There have been posed group shots, first day of school snaps, and hold up your Christmas present photos since photography became accessible to the masses. But the addition of interaction and validation has blurred the lines completely and permanently. There is pleasure in letting yourself be known. There is satisfaction that even given all the highly stylized, highly fictionalized evidence of your life, others approve. And especially as mothers, as women, I believe there is a desire to be seen. We go from being so visible during our pregnancies to being shoved aside the minute our babies are born. We step back into the shadows as the light, and attention, resources, and time shine down upon our children. Perhaps it is a way of reclaiming our space or some semblance of self. And maybe that's all just bullshit, and we're simply hungry for validation. Like I'm the expert. I'm also not a psychic. I have no ability to see 10 or 20 or 30 years into the future. I can't anticipate what all of this documenting and sharing has done to my kids. I only know what it's done to me. The sheer volume of photos I take of them has dropped steeply with each passing year. Although no one on social media would likely be able to tell the difference. They are getting older,
more aware of their digital presence. And I have stopped competing with other parents online to try to get the better photo of that thing our kids all do, whatever it is. I have tried harder to be respectful of what they want and what they don't want.